Bonjour à tous. Guess where I was for the feast? Okay, or I should say, la fête. Right, yes, back from Normandy. And I was talking with Mr. Greider right before services, and he's having trouble getting back to the right time zone. So am I still, even after a week. I'm still, it still feels like, 1 in the morning right now? So, anyway. But we had a wonderful time, and I would like to thank both Tony as well as Danica for a great introduction to what I'm going to be speaking on today. Both of them are really an introduction. It's interesting, the piece that Danica just played is called The Prelude, so it was indeed a prelude because I'm going to be speaking about just such things as that beautiful music that we just heard, as well as the topics heard earlier. I believe in signs. As we got on the plane to head for Normandy, well, Paris, that's where the plane was actually going. The shuttle took us to Normandy after that. But as we got on the plane and we sat down and we were moving along on the plane, my wife asked me, she said, she knew that I would be speaking right after the feast, the following Sabbath after the feast, and she asked me if I had a topic. And I said, well, no, but it'll come to me. It'll come to me. Now, she's used to this with me. It's not actually that I didn't have something. I always have a couple things on the computer that are ready to go. I have things that I've been working on that are in the can, but she also knows that I never do those unless there's something drastic happens. Like I find out an hour before that I have to speak or something, then I press print and I go with one of those things. But so this continued throughout the feast. She kept asking me if I'd come up with a topic yet. I said, no, nothing yet, not a thing. I told her I was waiting for God to give me a sign. So anyway, and then it happened. I was sitting at lunch, and of course, lunch in France is a wonderful thing. Okay, lasts a long time. It's the real reason to go. I won't get into all of that. But I was actually discussing with some of the church members there. John Labissonnière was actually one of them. Some might know that name. And this topic came up, and I was asked about this topic. And then at dinner, this topic came up again, the exact same one. I didn't bring it up. The exact same topic. People started asking me about this topic and my thoughts on this topic. And then strangely, right after dinner, there's a bar, a little kind of pub built into the complex where the feast is there. My wife came running up to me and saying, guess what? Because she had been involved with all these discussions. She said, I was just talking to a couple of the people in the choir, a couple of the guys in the choir. I wound up directing the choir. That's my connection with that. And guess what? They were asking me questions about just the exact topic that we had been discussing at lunch and at dinner. And they want to sit down at the bar and go over the topic. So I said, okay, well, that's it. That's a sign. Okay, right there, three times. Well, here was the topic. All of them started out by asking me my thoughts on the concept of talent, and what I thought about talent, and how I viewed it in my students, since I'm in the music and the teaching business and that sort of thing, and they assume that I see, quote, talent and maybe lack thereof and that sort of thing. They wanted my thoughts on that, and again, I just was an avalanche of questions on this topic, and the discussions went on and on. I mean, different things came up, like Mozart. They wanted to know because he was supposed to be such a prodigy, such a talent, and that sort of thing. Various other musicians came up. Vladimir Horowitz, the pianist, which I'm going to get to in just a moment. And we were discussing the fact that there are so many shows, TV shows and stuff now, about people displaying their talent and that sort of thing. But what I started with them, in just about every case, I said, do we put too much weight on talent? And in fact, some of them were asking that question too. And what I told them was that people considered to have talent by the general public generally don't believe in the concept of talent. Not in the way that the general public does, anyway. Not in the common perception. Or at least they consider it to be a very small part of their success in whatever business or art they are concerned. And this particular anecdote came up in several of these, in fact, I think in every one of the discussions I had. It was the story of an anecdote about Vladimir Horowitz, the great pianist. And I'm sure that many of you have heard this already, but I'll repeat it for everybody's benefit. The story goes something like this, that after playing one of his recitals, Horowitz was greeted at the reception room door by a woman who came up and said, "Oh, Mr. Horowitz, that was amazing, that was wonderful. I would do anything, I would give anything to play the way you played tonight." And of course, how many people have heard this story? Go ahead, a minute, all right. Okay, and the response was, "Oh, would you? Would you indeed give everything? Would you practice for years and years and years, minimum 6 hours a day, practicing brutally hard, 6 hours minimum a day, for decades and decades to play the way that I played tonight?" And the woman, of course, was taken aback and said, "I guess I wouldn't give anything to play the way you play." And he continued. He said, "Because that's what it takes." He says, "There's nothing special." He says, "It takes that. That's what it takes to play the way I played tonight." He said, "It just takes a lot of practice and hard work is what it is." My argument with all these parties that day was that it was not that what we needed to succeed in life and in our calling was not talent, but that it was another element of greater importance that is generally recognized by great people. And it's overlooked by the greater populace. In the course of this discussion, a couple of books came up. Now, I have to keep current on all the educational stuff that's going on. One of them is a book by that came out recently by Malcolm Gladstone called Outliers. And I see some heads out there nodding a little bit. Outliers, it's about exceptional people and what makes them exceptional. That's why it's called Outliers, people who lie outside the norm and that sort of thing. Again, by Malcolm Gladstone, if anybody is interested in that. Also by another one that related to this and kind of in juxtaposition to this one by Jeff Colvin, Colvin, is Talent is Overrated. That is the name of it, with the subtitle, What Really Separates World-Class Performers from Everybody Else? Talent is Overrated. What really separates world-class performers from everybody else? And so, in every discussion, we came to the consensus that people often mistakenly give credit to talent when something else is the real reason people stand out from the crowd. Talent is merely an outward expression or an instrument of this characteristic, but what is this internal engine that causes that talent to become evident to others? In all three of these conversations, we all came up with the same term at the conclusion of each one. We all agreed that the best term to sum up this trait possessed by outstanding individuals is one that's often used by these people and is often used in these books, and that is the term passion. Passion. And that is my title. Very simple. One word. Passion. But let's get back to talent for a moment. What is the origin of the modern concept of talent? Well, I started by going to my new Oxford American Dictionary. And definition number one, natural aptitude or skill. And I think that pretty well covers. I don't need to read other definitions. Number one there in my Oxford Dictionary pretty well covers it. But interestingly, down at the bottom, where it shows the etymology and development of the word, one of the things that it says is it says, for sense number one, that was the definition I just read, it said, is a figurative use with biblical allusion to the parable of the talents in Matthew 25. So it's interesting that the way people use that term today in various languages, because that word is used in various, it's not just an English language usage, because it actually goes back through the Latin to the original Greek, where it meant a weight or a value of money, something to be weighed on a scale that was of value. And so it's interesting that the world uses this biblical expression, but of course has kind of twisted it into a little bit different intent than it originally had. Now, passion, on the other hand, isn't from the Greek through the Latin. It's from the Latin patire, and that is the verb to suffer. In fact, in modern, I think we had some people that went to Italy for the feast this year, sitting here. That's the verb for suffer in Italian, which is, I guess, modern Latin, okay, as well. And that's kind of a clue as to perhaps where I'm going with this, as to why passion would be a better word for what people do, for what great exceptional people do to make themselves exceptional than what ordinary people do. So, that's where our term from passion comes from. So let's go to that source and let's start right there as a jumping off point. Let's go to Matthew 25. And trace the roots of this modern concept of talent, which in so many people's minds is it's like one of these magical things that people either have it or they don't. Matthew 25, and it starts in verse 14. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm sure probably everyone here has read it hundreds of times, most of us, word for word. So I will cover the high points. Verse 14, Matthew 25, for the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And he gave, and unto one he gave five talents, to another two, and to another one, to every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. And then we know that the one who had five took it out, and he traded with it, and he obtained another five. The one who had two took it out and traded with it and obtained another two talents. And, of course, the most famous one is the one who took it out and who took it and did nothing with it except hide it in the ground. He buried it in the ground. Now, they all received something. They all had talent, we could say. They all had talent. But two of them did something with it, and one of them did basically nothing with it. Now, as I mentioned before, talent is just a weight of measure. I've looked this up in Thayer's and several other sources, and of course, even my Oxford Dictionary has that. That's what it's from. It's just an instrument. It's not something of itself, and that's how it was used in this parable. It was used as an instrument to show some sort of skill in manipulating that instrument, this monetary instrument in this case. But let's focus on another word. What did the master use when he returned to determine how much, well, not when he returned, but initially when he meted out those talents? Everybody got some, but what did he use? And if we look back in verse 15, in my King James Version, it's a word that is translated as ability. It's translated as ability. It's very often translated as ability. However, there are various other ways to translate this word. And again, looking it up in a lexicon, it actually comes from a word that we've heard a lot about in our local congregation here over the last few years. And if I find where I put that, I will relay it to. Oh, yes, there we go. All right. Dunamis. Right. I recall hearing several of our speakers refer to this term. I'm looking at Mr. Fish right now, and he's referred to this because its power is one of the things. But it can be translated as virtue. It can be translated as spirit, as in having a good spirit, a willing spirit, that sort of idea like that. It's translated in a lot of ways in something that is motivational, something that is internally motivating, a power that motivates from within. And so, since parables are allegorical, nothing there is real, it's all representing something else, I'm going to take that word for the sake of my message as, and I'm going to translate it as passion. My contention is that's what that actually represents. That dunamis there is the passion. And also for convenience sake, I'm going to refer to the servants as servants A, B, and C. Just makes it a lot simpler that way. Now, servants A and B took their calling in this matter passionately. It's obvious at the end because they were told, well done, good and faithful servant, each one. And of course, servant C was lukewarm. He was aware of and mildly interested in his master's expectations, but there was no passion to do anything except hide what he'd been given. That was the problem. It wasn't that he was totally untrustworthy. It wasn't that he was an outsider. He was on the inside. He just was, as I said, I'll use the term lukewarm because that's where I'm going next. That was the problem. He wasn't passionate. He wasn't hot on this issue like the other two were. He was lukewarm. So that was the problem. What's the cure for that lukewarmness? Well, let's go to Revelation 3, because I did a search on this, and the King James Version anyway, I looked it up on the computer just this morning. It's the only time that the term lukewarm is used, so most of us probably know exactly where I'm going. Revelation 3, and I'm going to talk just hit on a couple of points to the message to the church at Laodicea. Revelation 3, and in 15 through 20, actually in 16, notice, actually starting earlier, a couple of verses earlier, Jesus said, I have a problem with this church. I have a problem with this congregation at Laodicea. And he finally gets down to what it is. He says they're neither cold nor hot. And in verse 16, he says that this congregation is lukewarm. That is the problem. And then he explains why they're lukewarm and what their issues are and all that. But what does he tell them to do to cure this? Well, in verse 19, about the middle of the verse, he says, be zealous therefore. There is the cure. Be zealous, therefore. Or, what is a synonym for zealousness? Is passion. Be passionate about my way. Don't be lukewarm about it. Be passionate. Many of these other churches are passionate about my way. That's why I'm looking, that's why I promised them great things. I didn't have to give even a couple of them any warnings. Because their passion is great for my way. But in the case of Laodicea, he's warning them that they need to take on that passion, that zeal that is currently missing from them. So zeal or zealousness is one of the many forms of this concept of passion. Zeal or passion is what God really wants of us. Let's just take a few biblical examples. Actually, one that I hadn't chosen was already given to us today, and that was Elijah. And I just thought, well, that was a perfect example. I'm glad that one didn't come to mind among many others. I probably would have chosen it, and then, of course, it would have been gone already. But Mr. Garcia already covered that for me. Elijah. Elijah is a great example of somebody who was passionate. And in fact, in places where he started to run out, of course, that's when he asked God for more of it. He said, I'm not passionate anymore. I'm the last one standing. So far as I can see, my passion is spent. And God gave him another infusion of passion because he asked for it. Again, I don't want to jump into somebody else's message. I'm just making the comment on that. But what about the kings of Israel and Judah? Remember the first couple of them? The first one wasn't David. The first one was Saul. And why was Saul replaced by David? Well, we could go through the whole story if we had more time. But I would contend that the reason was that Saul was not passionate for God's way, and David was. David had passion for God. In fact, it's expressed in that way. We all know the reference in Acts 13. No need to turn there, because I'm actually the reference in Acts 13 where it says, a man after God's own heart. It says that David was a man after God's own heart. That's actually not from Acts 13. That's a quote from 2 Samuel 7:21, where Samuel had come to Saul and told him why he was being replaced. He said that he was going to be replaced by someone who was after his own heart, after God's own heart. And therefore, someone who was passionate, someone who had passion for the way, for his calling. Whereas Saul did not. Saul was lukewarm. Saul went whichever way the wind blew, whichever way was in his favor at the time. He might have had an outward show of passion occasionally, but it was just a facade. What about at the other end of the kings? What about Josiah? Josiah. Most of us can think fondly of the story of Josiah, the last righteous king. Let's just turn there. I do have a little bit of time. That's right. I've got a split sermon today. All right. Let's take a look and just see here. 2 Chronicles 34, right in verse 1. 2 Chronicles 34, verse 1. Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 130 years, as it says in my dignified King James on computer Bible, all right, which I have printed out in front of me. This is just a prop. It is a Bible, but I'm not really looking at it, so this is much easier to read. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, and walked in the ways of David his father, and declined neither to the right hand nor to the left. Right from the start, there couldn't be enough praise heaped on this. And for those who haven't read the story recently, go back and read it. It's not directly what I'm going to be talking about today, the whole story, but basically, when he saw that he wasn't headed in the right direction, his zeal, his passion just poured out and said, we got to do something about this. We have to do something about it. And he was told by the prophetess that he would be rewarded for that, that there was a great reward for his passion towards his God. And so, again, huge difference from so many of the kings of Israel and Judah. And he was rewarded for it. We have his story to this day, if that's not a reward enough, that he's spoken of so glowingly to this day. A good name he definitely has. But here's one of my favorite ones. What about Job? Now, there are all kinds of opinions about Job and what his trials really meant and all that kind of stuff. I'm not going to get into that. But in the first chapter of Job, and there's no need to turn there, most of us are familiar with the story, that Satan comes before God and says, and God says, look at Job. There's a guy with passion for my way. And what is Satan's case against Job? His case is that Job doesn't really have passion. Basically, Satan comes before the throne of the Eternal and says, Job is really just lukewarm. His piety is just a facade. His apparent passion is self-serving. Once he's put under pressure, it will be obvious that he is really just lukewarm. And of course, God said, well, go ahead and test him, but don't kill him. But personally, my personal opinion is I don't think Satan wanted to kill him. I don't think Satan wanted to kill him at all. I think Satan really believed what he was saying about Job, but Satan wanted to keep Job around as long as possible as a tepid, unprofitable servant, a type C servant, so that he could continually claim victory before the throne of God. Keep coming back and throwing this forward and saying, see, he's down there. He's still alive after all these years. Okay, and see, and he's just a lukewarm guy. He's just that sort of thing. Because Satan knew the rules of the game. Satan knew the rules of the game. And here's what I consider to be the rules of the game from what we've learned from the parable of the talents as well as from the message to Laodicea. When we are hot or passionate, God wins. Or we could say we win. Again, if we want to put this in terms of worldly endeavors, like, let's say, becoming a pianist, a great pianist like Horowitz, okay, whether we're talking about in the church, our holy calling, or we're talking about a professional calling or something like that, one way or the other, when we're hot or passionate, God wins and we win. When we're cold or dead, whether literally or figuratively, no one really wins. No one really wins because it's a nothing. There's nothing there. But when we are lukewarm or tepid, merely aware or mildly interested in whatever we feel our calling is, again, whether in the church or out of the church, Satan or the opponent wins. Once again, the final point is when we're lukewarm or tepid, merely aware or mildly interested, the opponent wins. The opponent wins. We are alive, but we are unprofitable. We are servant C in that case. Now, God gave Job many talents earlier in his life, and after he had maintained his passion and endured to the end, God returned those talents, those instruments of monetary success and wealth. God returned those talents to him, and more, we know at the end of the story. As with Job, we are not called to have talent, but passion. We are entrusted with talent in measure according to our passion. The message of the parable of the talents is that we should be passionate, not for talent in the sense that the word is commonly used today, but that we should seek first the kingdom of God. Of course, a reference back to Matthew 6:33. That's what it really is. It's that we should seek first. That's what that really means, is that we are to have passion to seek God's kingdom and his righteousness. We should be passionate for that way. Satan would like nothing better than to take the wind out of our sails, to leave us stranded in the sea. Not to have the ship sink, certainly not to have the wind strong and to have us move forward, but just to have us there stopped in the midst of the sea. The lukewarm, the servant sea approach. Also, it is interesting to note that the parables Jesus told at the end of his ministry, just before his passion on the cross, we just sang of in the last hymn, are about passion, even more so than many of his others. In fact, right before in Matthew 25 is the parable of the 10 virgins and the ones that had passion and the ones that were just, yeah, we know about it. We're just kind of lukewarm about it. And again, the difference there. And the one right after the parable of the talents, of the sheep and the goats. Again, the sheep being the passionate ones, the goats being the lukewarm. Okay, so now we know what passion is. And I brought this up to my wife. I said, okay, here it is. We know what it is. She says, okay, now what are we supposed to do about it if we don't have it? Okay, well, I said, well, I don't know if I'm going to get to that, but I'm going to get to it. All right. We see what passion is the key to being a profitable servant, an A or B type servant. And that talent is simply a vehicle for expressing that passion. But what is the practical aspect? How do we get there? Now, I don't know of any checklist in the Bible that says, here are 12 easy steps to being zealous, or something like that, or acquiring passion. But there are some verses that I would like to cite in a moment that give us a pretty good indication. But I want to go back to what some of these people like Colvin and Gladwell. Did I say Gladstone before? It's Gladwell, right? Yeah, okay, it's Gladwell. Sorry. And many others who are there. There's just a whole slew of these books that are coming out right now on these same topics. But I want to go back to what some of the things they say are the differences, because the differences are really the same. The difference between those perceived to have talent, the outliers, as the one book calls them, and the ordinary people whose talent might be hidden. The Horowitz anecdote actually holds the key, the story I told earlier. It's very simply, Colvin's book on talent is overrated basically says it is practice. It is just practice. That is the key to overcoming a lack of zeal, a lack of passion. It is practice. It's that simple. Yes, it's brutal hard work. And I think that's a thing that a lot of times I see this in students. I'll have students come to me, and they really, when they first come, let's say I'll have a university student that comes as a freshman, and I remember one, I'll call her Susie, okay? And this was years ago, and her name wasn't Susie, but she just thought that she had come to believe that there was this thing called talent, and that she would just kind of show up, and she would just get better by kind of being there. And she got very frustrated near the end of her first year, and it was a difficult circumstance. I have something that I write on the board every year when a student comes in. I have in my studio at California State University, Northridge, and I've had students come back to me and tell me year after year, many years later, that they took that with them. They remember that. I always wait for a student to start telling me. I'll say, tell me about how you feel about your studies with music and how you play your instrument and all that sort of stuff. And I'll just wait. And says, well, I have trouble with, and I yell, stop. Because I wait for that. Or I'm not good at, I yell, stop. I can't do, and I yell, stop. I yell, stop. And I go over to the board, and I write that. And it stays up all year. Because everybody comes in and falls into the same trap. So I'll write, I'm not good at, and I put a blank there. Blank, period. And I put a number one by it. I said, now, I'm going to write a question on the board. And tell me if statement number one, is it all related to question number two? And I put number two, how often do I practice blank? And I have never had a student say to me, oh, there's no relationship at all. I'm not good at this, but I practice it all the time. No, they really are. So many of them come in believing that, yeah, world-class performers or whatever, or scholars or athletes or whatever, they're just born with it. It just falls out of the sky for them. It's talent. Somebody delivers it, okay, on the UPS truck. And that sort of thing. And so I'll do that. Say, no. Well, basically, this is the same thing that these people say in just a multitude of books, is that it's not talent. And that's what Horowitz was saying when he responded to that woman so abruptly, is he was saying, it's not talent. It's just, I'm good at this. Number one, I am good at this because I practice this every day. If I can do this particular thing, I'm good at it. So, passion doesn't mean that there is no effort. It just means that the effort is worth it. It just means that the effort is worth it. After all, isn't that what it says in Hebrews 12:2 about our greatest example? Again, there's no need to turn there. But in Hebrews 12:2, it says, we look to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Is anybody out there going to tell me that what he did wasn't hard to do? I mean, it says it was one of the toughest things in the world to do. But it was worth it, is what it says in Hebrews 12, too. He thought it was worth it. He despised the shame. Just like Horowitz, when he would get out there on the floor, would say, it's all worth it. I can't even bring to mind at the moment all the years of my life I've spent practicing. Because right now, it's worth it. And so it's the same thing. That's it. It's not that passion doesn't involve effort. It's just that that passion makes it worth it. It makes the effort worth it. One of my favorite examples, the one that came up several times, was Mozart. People asked me about Mozart. What about Mozart? I told them, I said, Mozart worked hard. The only thing different about Mozart was that he had a father that instilled this ethic in him when he was less than 3 years old. Mozart was composing at 5. Now, I've written a few pieces of music, but Mozart, when he died at 35 years old, had well over 600 works in his catalog. And I'm not talking about 3-minute pop songs. We're talking about entire symphonies and operas and things like that. I've written a few pieces of music, but I figured that if I put what I have put together, well, everything that I've written in music so far, and I put it next to Mozart, I'm about equal to age 6 and a half for him right now. He wrote his first symphony when he was 8 years old. I haven't written mine yet. I'm working on it, but it's not complete. And at this rate, yeah, compared with Mozart, all right. So anyway, Mozart, when he was 14, went to Bologna because this was the place where people went to take an exam just to see if they had all the academic skills that they were supposed to have. Again, people think Mozart just fell out of the sky. He didn't study. He told his father he wanted to go to Bologna at 14 because he wanted to prove to himself that he had all the academic skills. And when he showed up to take the exam, and go ahead and Google this because they actually have a picture of the exam that he took. They have it up there to this day, and there's a picture of it in Wikipedia. I just looked at it this morning again. They laughed, and they said, okay, well here, sure, go ahead, take the exam, 14-year-old boy, imagine that. Go ahead, go on in, take the exam. He came out a few minutes later with the exam, and the guy administering the test, Padre Martini, said, oh, finish so soon? Give up so soon? He said, no, I'm done. And of course, it was perfect. The point is, it wasn't talent. It was incredible hard work that went into that. There are many verses we could quote to put this skill in perspective. Matthew 24:13 is one that people could write down if they wish. We all know it. There's probably no need for most of us. He that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. Endure, not wait. Endure. We're talking about practicing. We're talking about what we heard about in the first message today. Persistence. Persistence. That's what passion is. It's persistence. That's what Elijah had. That's why he got where he got. What about the parable of the pearl of great price? Very short. That encapsulates it in Matthew 13:45. A man that he sold all that he had because it was worth it. That's it. It's practice. Everything else, it didn't matter. The practice is worth it. On the flight back, I was thinking maybe that was just an aberration about that I should speak on passion. I never watch movies, but on a flight, especially an 11-and-a-half-hour flight, there's not much else to do. And I saw, guess what they were playing? The Soloist. Okay, so some people are out there. And I remember that line, it just hit me, where the reporter is going, I can't believe this guy. He says, this guy has passion. I've never had passion in my life. I remember, I was going, oh no, I've got to give this message. All right, there's no escaping this. Somebody's after me. Okay, so anyway, for those who haven't seen it, there's a very good message there about passion in that film. And again, I don't know much about films because I hardly watch any. That's the only time I'm forced to actually sit down for that long in one place. Passion has many synonyms, as I mentioned. If another synonym like fervor or enthusiasm or fieriness or fervency or even obsession fits better, please go ahead and use that one in place of passion. And I'm sure many out there are saying, oh, but he could have quoted this passage or that passage or that passage to show more about passion. Well, great. Then please pursue that. I hope that this leads to many discussions on this topic, as it did with me during the feast. But whatever we do, whether in our pursuits in living this life or in the pursuits of our holy calling, let's do it with passion. That's what God really wants of us. He wants us to have passion. Let's be passionate, so that one day we might hear those cherished words, "Well done, good and faithful servant."